Blog Talk Radio.
The clock goes tick tock, the heartbeat hip hop. You know there's something greater you're called to be. You shut tight your eyes and breathe.
Welcome to Shapeshifting. I'm Lisa Bonnies, and I'm your host for this special edition of the show. As those of you who are regular listeners know, we kind of go back and forth now. It used to be a regular thing, and now it's just when I get an amazing guest. For those of you who are new to the show, I'm the author of Shapeshifting, Reclaiming Your Perfect Body, the stress is on the word your, and the soon-to-be-released Shapeshifter's Daily Diary, a daily journal designed to work with your efforts to manifest a more genuine and soul-connected life. And you can find out everything you need to know about that at shapeshiftingonline.com. And those of you who have read the book are aware that it's a body-mind-spirit look at health and weight balancing. And this radio show is designed to bring more information along those lines into our awareness. And that's why interviewing today's guest is so very exciting to me. I first heard of Julie Motz, author of Hands of Life, from a dear friend who's dealing with a tumor in her breast and is dealing with that situation from an entirely holistic angle. She's not doing the chemo, radiation, or surgery. And when we were recently discussing the path she's on, she told me about this book, and, well, I immediately ordered a copy and was just blown away. Julie Motz, the author, is an energy healer and medical intuitive who, since 1986, has been healing, lecturing, teaching, and writing about energy fields, healing alternative medicine in various venues, a huge number of venues. And she's worked with Oprah's favorite doctor, Mehmet Oz, at Columbia for 2 years. She was the person who introduced him to energy medicine and proposed a hypnosis experiment, which was his first venture into research in the use of alternative medicine for heart patients. Amazing stories in this book. The book also includes a great deal of information about energy healing work that she did during mastectomies and other breast cancer treatments, and the information she imparts about what she learned to be the energetic causes of that disease led me to wonder if she ever looked into weight issues. Now, granted, wanting to lose weight is nowhere near as scary as breast cancer, but it is an issue that breaks the hearts of so many people, you know, me included. A body out of balance is a body out of balance. So I searched the internet to find out if she's done any work on the topic since the publication of her book, and lo and behold, I discover she's teaching a seminar in April in the Berkshires on the topic of how to have an appetite you can trust and a body you can love. Never one to ignore synchronicity, I immediately contacted her to find out if she would be a guest on the show, and we are in luck. I'll be bringing her on in just a second. Julie is an internationally known energy healer who has worked side-by-side with surgeons in operating rooms across the country. She's been profiled on Dateline, CNN, the Discovery Channel, and she's been featured in the New York Times Magazine, Prevention Psychology Today, and she's also the founder of Health Angels, an organization that brings healing to underserved populations. Let's go ahead and get the show started. Julie, it is a pleasure to have you here today.
And it's a delight to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for being I've been so looking forward to talking to you. As I mentioned when we first talked about a week or so ago, I read your book and I just couldn't put it down. The stories that you tell. For those of you who haven't read the book, which I highly recommend, listeners can find a link to purchase it on the shapeshiftingonline.com radio page. Give us just a quick background on your work with Dr. Oz and in the breast cancer surgeries.
Well, I was actually a graduate student in the School of Public Health at Columbia, and I'd gone there because I had taken on this enormous mission that I was going to change healthcare in this country by bringing alternative medicine into the mainstream.
Good for
this
you.
Is way back in 1994. I can't tell you, you know, it's more than 15 years ago how different things were. And so I thought had been a documentary filmmaker for 20 years, and I thought a nice change from the freewheeling life of a documentary filmmaker to the constrained life of the healthcare bureaucrat would be graduate school. So I signed up to get a master's in public health. And the public health school at Columbia is on the same campus as the medical school and the major hospitals, all the research hospitals. Of course, this was a huge mistake. As you know, 1 week in graduate school, I mean, I could barely sit behind a desk for 2 hours a day. You know, I knew I wasn't going to.
Right.
I wasn't going to. I would go through the program, but I wasn't going to end up in healthcare administration. But I decided, sort of on a lark, that I would try to hunt out other people on the medical campus of Columbia University who were interested in alternative medicine. So I made up a little badge, like those conventioneers' badges you get, you know, when you go to a convention and it said, interested in alternative medicine? Talk to me.
Huh.
Well, of course, nobody did, although three people on the subway stopped me to ask me about herbs, acupuncture, and reflexology. But nobody on the medical campus. And then I heard that Columbia had gotten a grant to open a research facility in alternative medicine. But I also heard that they were terrified to spend any of the money because Columbia lawyers didn't want people calling up some number at Columbia and saying, what's the best alternative remedy for XYZ?
Okay.
So they were kind of frozen.
Uh-huh.
And so what they did was they sent out a questionnaire about, you know, what people knew, if they'd used it themselves. And I got back a number of anonymous answers from physicians and researchers saying they had used alternative medicine themselves, but they would not use it for their patients.
Uh-huh.
I found that interesting, and also the fact that the answers were submitted anonymously.
Huh.
But just, and I had decided to work there as a volunteer, and just as the director was going into despair, she told me that we'd gotten a call from cardiothoracic surgery and that they were interested. Well, cardiothoracic surgery is one of the huge profit centers at Columbia. So I got very excited. I said, you know, they make more money than God. We'll do a study. We'll put Dean Ornish to shame. We'll fly all over the world. You know, so I said, you know, where do we start? She said, well, there's this guy, Mehmet Oz. You know, he's the guy who called, so why don't you call him back? So I called this guy back, and I discovered very quickly that they were not going to give us any money. They were hoping that alternative medicine could bring in even more money for them. You know,
uh-huh.
So I wanted to get off the phone very quickly, so I mentioned that I was an energy healer, and I thought that would end the conversation. It didn't. He said, well, do you know anything about other alternative branches of medicine? As a matter of fact, I've been writing magazine articles in this field for about 5 years, you know, so I said, yeah, I do. He said, well, would you come in for a meeting? So I thought, well, you know, the director of our research institute is a woman and a PhD. He's a male and an MD. Guess who has more clout
uh-huh.
at a major medical research facility? So I said, yes, I'd be delighted to come. And I thought somehow at least we could use their influence. If they liked us, other departments might get interested. I thought maybe there's something to be gotten here. So I went for this meeting, and of course, the first moment I got off the elevator and opened the double glass doors to the offices, you sink into the pile rug up to your knees. You're nearly blinded by the glare from the finish on the mahogany furniture. I mean, you know this is a profit center for the hospital.
Right.
So I was directed back to this room, and this tall, good-looking guy who looks something like a cross between, you know, Clark Gable and Omar Sharif walks in. He looks much too young to be a surgeon. I think he was 39 in those days.
Wow.
And he introduces himself as, he says, I'm Mehmet, you know, and said, and so we sat down, and there was a patient relations person. There was a guy who worked the pump, which is the bypass machine, who was interested in this stuff. And there was the standard Centrum Central Casting nutritionist, overweight and with a bad complexion.
Right.
And the moment I said, well, the first thing we should do is have organic food, she looked at me and she said, I believe in democracy. I think patients should have a choice about what they eat, as if any patient ever even gets what he indicates on his little menu chart in the hospital sent him correctly. So, you know, and then Mehmet took me aside. He said, Julie, maybe in my hospital 20 years from now, but not in this hospital, not here, not now. We're not going to fight this battle. What else do you have? So I came back a week later with a list of everything from clean the room with only organic cleansers, at which point the patient advocate leaned over and said, let's just get them to clean the rooms, Julie. Okay, let's just start with that. using that everybody, you know, should be trained to touch, everyone who's touching the patient, from the nurses to the transport workers, should be trained in some kind of healing touch methodology, so everybody, you know, feels they're collaborating and healing. But what I suggested that we start with was a hypnosis experiment, because I knew one had been done across town at Mount Sinai Medical Center, and it had been so successful they had broken the blind, because the hypnosis patients were doing so much better than the others.
Right.
They started using it for everybody. So I said, look, they have a protocol. It's gotten through their institutional review board. I'm sure it could be adapted and used over here. And Mehmet was very excited about that. The problem with the experiment, as far as I was concerned, is that the beauty of hypnosis is that you personalize. But because they wanted to make this, in quotes, a scientific experiment, they did the standard routine of hypnosis for everybody. And I think that's why they didn't get really outstanding results.
Right.
But I thought my job was done. And so he looked at me and said, well, what are you going to do? And I thought, well, what do you think am I going to do? I've given you the benefit of my priceless advice. I'm going to get out of here. But it was very clear that he expected me to do something. So I said, and I think the patients who were going into hypnosis experiment were first-time coronary bypass with no complications. So I said, I'll work with your other patients. What do you guys? So, well, I have heart transplants. I have mechanical heart implants. I have lung transplants. I said, great, I'll do energy healing on them. And he said, you cannot say that you're doing energy healing.
Oh, right.
I said, fine, Mehmet. I'll say I'm doing energy evaluations. Is that okay? And he said, fine, yes. So I called up a couple of friends of mine who had also, you know, dabbled in this area. And because I didn't want to, the hospital is not a very cheerful place, and
right.
I didn't want to be there alone.
Right.
And so we developed a kind of routine where, you know, Mehmet would lean over the patient and say, this is my colleague, Miss Motz. And she does, no, no, no. And he'd mumble something under his breath that I couldn't hear or understand, and they couldn't hear or understand. And he said, would that be all right with you? And they'd look up from their beds of pain at this tall, good-looking guy who had just saved their life or was just about to save their life. And they'd say, oh, yes, Dr. Oz, that would be just fine. And then he'd sweep out of the room with his white coat flapping behind him, and they would stare at me and my two colleagues, terrified, and say, what are you going to do to me? And I said, I'm going to touch you and make you feel better. What a thrilling notion, because since from the moment they'd hit the hospital doors, no one had done anything but poke them and make them feel worse.
Right.
So I began doing very standard, early, primitive, energy healing work, what we used to call in the old days chelation, where you do certain patterns on the body and you work on the energy centers called the chakras. But I very quickly discovered in my work that there was a lot of emotions going on with these patients. I was doing very simple pain elimination. And the thing that, the first dramatic thing that happened was that I was working on a patient, and the third week I came back, his wife said, you know, he always feels great when you leave. I had actually gotten him out of pain and into physical therapy, into rehab,
uh-huh.
which they were very grateful for because that's where the hospital loses most of its money. So I said, but he just gets depressed after you leave. So as I was driving home, it occurred to me, I wonder if he misses his old heart. You know, so I came back and I said, Peter, it occurred to me, do you miss your old heart? He burst into tears. He said, no one has asked me that. Of course I do. So I said, okay, we're going to do a little ritual. We're going to a little ceremony around this. So I said, first, I want you to think about your old heart. And I want you to thank it for everything it did to love the people you loved, to protect you, to protect them. And now I want you to very, very gently let it go. And I want you to know that if there is a heaven for hearts, your heart has certainly gone there. And then I said, and now I want you to think about your new heart. And I want you to welcome it into your body because, you know, if it weren't for you, this heart would have no life. And I thought this was very important because heart patients do experience a certain amount of survivor guilt.
Uh-huh.
They know that somebody has to die for them
right.
to live.
Exactly.
So I said, this would have no life if it weren't for you. So I want you to welcome it into your body, and I want you to feel it accepting, taking on the work that the old heart left behind. And I want you to tell us that you want all of its information, too, and all of its history. And by the time I left, he had gone to sleep, and the wife and the daughter had gone to sleep. When I came back next week, the wife told me not only had they had this peaceful rest, the daughter who had had a migraine headache and that had vanished, and Peter was smiling. And she said, he now has two wives. He's married to me and he's married to his heart. And I later found out that the people who have the most successful long-lasting transplants are people in whose bodies the new heart has started to manufacture the same DNA as their own bodies.
Oh, really?
And what I was actually doing was encouraging and supporting that. And that made me realize that there is no medical procedure that can't be enhanced by addressing the emotions of the patient and the emotions of the part of the body, and addressing the part of the and evoking the intelligence of that part of the body.
Wow, that's so powerful. Because I know that back in those days, I mean, even today, you're going to get people rolling their eyes. I'm sure you see that all the time. But back then, oh my God!
You know what they said to me? They said to me, "How can you anthropomorphize the body? Like, how can you make the body something human?
How can you not?"
Yes. And even though some of the things I did seem dramatic, it always seemed to me that I was just putting one foot in front of the other, foot in front of the other.
Right.
It's how I eventually walked into surgery after working with people before surgery and after surgery. Going into surgery just seemed to me the natural next step. You know, it wasn't, everything had, to me, it had a concrete logic to it, even though that may have eluded many other people. Mm-hmm. Or at least it had an internally consistent logic.
Right. It just makes a certain kind of sense if you think a certain way, if you are a certain kind of, if you have a certain kind of understanding of life that, again, that's why your book spoke to me, is because I totally get what you're talking about here. It just makes sense. And when you talk to people who don't think this way, you go, how can you not understand how this works?
Yeah, and actually the reason I eventually moved on to breast cancer patients after working with a lot of patients, I also worked with patients of the chief of neurosurgery, was that Columbia wasn't interested in raising any money for me to do any of my work.
Uh-huh.
And I knew someone who ran a small foundation for alternative cancer therapies, and I convinced them to give me a grant.
Great.
And so I got a grant originally in New York to work with women having surgery for breast cancer, and then out here, because California Pacific Medical Center out in California wanted to bring me out to do lecturing and give workshops, and I said, let's see if we can get a grant. You know, and I got a grant from the Susan G. Komen Foundation to do many more women. I spent 5 months working with women having surgery for breast cancer.
Wow, that's wonderful. You got a grant from the Komen Foundation.
Yeah, it was great.
Huh. So now the part in your book where you talk about all of these surgeries, you're actually in the room during the mastectomy, and you would talk about how after the breast was actually removed, you could feel from this now removed flesh, you could even feel emotions from that.
Well, I could determine whether the material was cancerous or not, because cancerous material, you feel the rage. You absolutely feel the rage. And if it's benign, you don't feel that. You just don't feel anything.
Okay. So this actually goes to my understanding of cancer basically is that it's anger that's repressed and kept inside, that type of thing. But you also carried this even further into where your relationship with your mother, everybody blames the mother. This isn't blaming the mother. This is looking at energy patterns.
Curiously, everybody doesn't blame the mother. Most breast cancer patients don't blame their mothers. And the most tragic thing was to see a breast cancer patient have her very narcissistic mother come and visit and make it all about her, about the mom, and not about the sick daughter. And I saw that over and over again. And there was this last hope that, sick as I am, maybe at last my mother will be focused on me.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
So were you seeing that this might have been an underlying pattern in these women's cancer?
I think that breast cancer represents a failure to be nurtured.
Right.
And it affects the nurturing part, because essentially if you haven't been nurtured, the part of you that is supposed to nurture, your breasts,
uh-huh.
are under tremendous stress because you're being asked to give from a well that's empty.
Mm, okay. Now, I remember reading a study many years ago where they were saying that there was a link between women who'd had abortions and breast cancer, and they were trying to make it a medical thing, but if we look at this from an energy standpoint, to me, this made sense that if you've gone through an abortion, maybe you have guilt, whatever it is that you're feeling emotionally, I can understand how that would affect the nurturing part of your body.
It's beyond that. Most women who have abortions have mothers who wanted to or actually tried to abort them.
No kidding.
Yes, it's just a repetition of a pattern. Yeah. And they're actually tragically identified with the very fetus they're aborting.
Huh.
They're completing what their mothers didn't.
No kidding.
And trying to get that feeling out of their bodies. Yeah, it's part of the same pattern.
So it was that their mother wanted to abort them or
yes,
any
their mother,
of the children?
Their mother wanted to abort them and probably any of the children. These probably are women who, even though intellectually they might have said it's a great idea to be a mom on a much more visceral level, did not want to be mothers at all and felt terribly drained
right.
and stressed by it.
Well, this actually brings me to a question that I'm wondering because, you know, I'm a mom, I've had kids, and I got to tell you the honest truth. When I found out that I was pregnant with one of them, I don't want to say which because, you know, I don't want them to necessarily know I'm talking about
it's okay.
Them.
They know it unconsciously anyway.
Okay, that's true. And in fact, I've actually discussed this with her. When I found out I was pregnant with my second child, I was desperate to get out of that marriage. So when I heard you are pregnant, oh, my God, the despair. You know, now I'm so happy that I had her because she's just an amazing human being. But that doesn't change the fact that way back then she was affected. So how does a parent who is now aware of this help their child to work this out?
Simply by telling the truth.
Okay.
simply by telling the truth. Because my mother had the same feeling when I, as a second child, was born, and she didn't tell me. And she didn't tell me. So I had this mysterious feeling my whole life of being unwanted or that someone was out to get me until I finally figured out what happened. It's simply by telling the truth. I worked with a kid in Hawaii. He was 5 years old, and his parents were very concerned that he was very hyperactive and very violent. You know, and sort of, I mean, of course, they didn't let him play with guns, but he went around trying to shoot everybody with his fingers anyway.
Right.
And the mother told me that she had thought of aborting this child. And I said, you have to tell him. You really have to tell him. And she was horrified. Now, this is a laugh. So I said, okay, we'll do one session and see how it goes. And this kid had had a cesarean birth, and it was on Hawaii, and there was this huge painting there of the goddess of the volcano, Pele. And the moment he walked in, he just stood and stared at the painting and stared at the painting. And he told me that whenever there's anything about volcanoes on television, he's just mesmerized by it. I said, because that's like a cesarean birth. That's what it's like, a volcano erupting, suddenly being jerked out of this thing. And so when he went on, you know, when he would like point his fingers at his parents, you know, bang, bang, they would fall down dead. But when he pointed his fingers at me, I would jump up and down and say, that's exciting, that's exciting. Because I felt there was a way to transform this imagery from murder to actually ejaculation and copulation and implantation for this kid, which had almost been a death sentence for him. The very fact that he was conceived had almost been a death sentence. And I asked him at that time, and then what I had him do is I had him act out the sperm. I had him dive into a pile of pillows over and over and over again, which he felt was tremendously exciting. And then I said, do you want to reenact your birth? You know, and he said, absolutely not. So when I talked to the mother later that week, she said that he'd calmed down somewhat. But, you know, that he was still giving them a lot of trouble. And I said, you know, you have to tell him. So the next session, you know, he was sort of running all around the room. And then she says, I want to tell you what happened right after you were born. He became totally silent and walked over and just stared into her eyes. And she said, it was a very difficult time between me and Daddy. And very frankly, I didn't want you, and I thought of killing you. And he was just, like that. But, you know, I decided not to, and the moment you were born, I fell madly in love with you. And then she kind of looked at me and sort of mouthed, do I have to tell him about the other one? Because this couple had had an abortion before, and I shook my head and I said yes. And she said, and before that, I did kill a baby. And he said, how did you do it? How did you do it? How did you do it with a knife? And she said, no, I did it with a vacuum. And she made this movement with her hands, like, you know, the way a vacuum sucks up. And he went around the furniture going, making this noise and this thing with his fingers. And then he turned and he said, did you do it because it was a bad baby? And again, she looked at me and I said, no, your mother did it because it was a bad time in her life. But if she hadn't done it, there wouldn't have been room in her life for you. And you could see his shoulders just relaxed completely.
Huh.
And then when I said, and would you like to redo your birth? He said, yes, but you go first. So first I had to, and what I did to simulate a cesarean is I had his mother get between the couch and the pillow in front of it, and I pulled her out from between the couches. Then I did that with his father. Then I had him do it. And finally I got him between, you know, the couch and the pillow, and we all pulled him out. And the other thing is the reason they decided to have a cesarean was that he had had the cord wrapped around his neck. He was breech. But babies very often become breech because if you're breech and the cord is around your neck, you can unwrap the cord as you come out of as you move down.
Uh-huh.
But if they try to turn you, you'll choke to death. So the father said he has a habit of wrapping a scarf around his neck and asking me to take it off, and wrapping a scarf around his neck and asking me to take it off. I said, the next time he does it, you ask him to take it off. You ask him to unwrap it himself, and he did, and the child never did that thing with a scarf again. The other thing is, the mother decided that she was going to stay home. She had gone to work 3 months after he had been born. And I think she'd gone to work because she felt she couldn't bear to be around him because she felt so guilty about not having wanted him. Now that this was all out in the open, she felt comfortable being a stay-at-home mom again, and he was getting more mommy. So he became much less violent, no more acting out, no more ADD, you know. But it came through this patient and careful negotiating of telling the child the truth.
That's amazing. Wow.
It is. It's amazing, and it makes sense. It goes contrary to everything we're told, but if we tune into our instincts, it makes perfect sense.
Uh-huh.
You know, when you say, and the truth shall set you free, it truly does. Because the truth wasn't being told, it's like, oh, I never wanted you. It wasn't being told to hurt him.
Right.
It was told to bring him closer.
Right.
To make him closer, to be more inclusive of him, not less inclusive.
So how do you, I can see how that would be very difficult for a mom.
Oh, it was,
she
was terrified. She was terrified. She was terrified.
So
but
how
when
did
she
you
said,
help her?
I just said, you know, you really have a choice here. You know, you can become more and more distant from your child, and he can become more and more difficult, or you can take this tremendous risk and see what happens.
Well, do you think that it was necessary for her to use such really harsh language, saying, I killed a baby? Would it be okay to...
How else could you describe it?
Well, I guess... I guess it depends on how old the child is.
This is a five-year-old.
Okay.
I think you have to be very explicit.
Okay. All right.
Because you walk. First of all, a child in a womb where there's been an abortion, it's like living in a haunted house. It's like trying to sleep in a bedroom where someone has been murdered.
Wow.
He feels that every moment of his fetal development. Someone has been killed here. Someone has been killed here.
Wow.
So to make it concrete, to give him the information, I'll tell you one thing I did, though, before I did this. I did a session with the mother where I had her do a farewell ceremony to the child she aborted.
Uh-huh.
Where she thanked it for the time it had come to spend with her, and then let it go.
Okay, and now how did that actually, why did you have her do this? How did this help?
Well, it's something I recommend for all women who've had abortions, because it's a way of coming to terms with their feelings about it, that it is a real loss, but that also whatever time they spent with that child was valuable time, that there was a communication and a connection.
Right, okay. So then... going back to women and breast cancer, we'll get to the weight thing in a minute, but I'm just so fascinated by this. Women who do end up with breast cancer as a result of, maybe not as a result of, but connected to the idea of having an abortion, how can they bring this into play?
Well, first of all, what I suggested is where you put your hand over your womb and you connect the energy of that of a child who died, and then you let it go, you know, to reincarnate or to have some kind of life somewhere else, and you thank the child for the time it spent with you. But I think the most important thing, you know, for women is really to go back to those very early painful days of their own lives in the womb and their own lives of infants of not getting nurtured, and to connect with the infant rage at the mother and the fetal rage at the mother. No matter how they feel about the mother now, that early rage is still in the body, and that has to be expressed and released.
Okay, so how do they, I mean, if they don't have Julie Mott's in the room with them, how can somebody actually just do this on their own?
Well, actually, in my book, Hands of Life, I do describe some prenatal regressions. You know, I describe situations where I took people back, and I think that's a guide. But if you just breathe, if you lie down and breathe as if you're breathing through your navel, and you imagine your body as if it had radial symmetry with the navel at the center rather than bilateral symmetry, that's how a fetus experiences itself. You can drift back to that time inside the womb. And just imagine yourself there and then feel in. Of course, it's much easier if there's somebody there talking you through it. But you feel into the energy of your mother around you and what she's going through, and you tell her what you wanted to tell her then.
Hmm.
And maybe it's take care of me, and maybe it's don't drink or don't have that cup of coffee or don't smoke that cigarette.
Right. One of the things you mentioned in the book that, again, fascinating, was that babies, fetuses, while they're still in there, if the mother is ingesting some sort of toxin, the baby will actually squeeze the umbilical cord.
Yes, we have videotapes. The baby will squeeze the umbilical cord to try to stop the blood flow, but of course then the heart rate drops, so it has to loosen it. And this is one of the tragic things that happens. And my own feeling, I think this is a setup for later sexual abuse or passivity in the face of sexual abuse, because when you're a fetus, you have to let poison into your body as well as the stuff that you want. You don't have a choice.
Right.
And I think the shock that the fetus goes into, and also a fetus with a mother who is taking toxins to her body, is not likely to be very well cared for after birth.
Right. Well, but she's on prescription medications that the doctor's giving her.
Yeah, but if she's on prescription medications, it means there's something going on with her to begin with that she's not dealing with.
True enough.
Either emotionally or, you know, physically. But I think that when somebody, another person who's very close or appears to be a close and powerful adult, approaches and wants to do something to your body, you go into shock because your feeling is connection at any cost. And that's very similar to being in the womb and saying blood at any cost.
Wow. Okay. Well, that would certainly explain why all of this is just so very prevalent, because I don't know anybody who doesn't ingest something I mean, well, it's just junk food.
Yeah. Well, yes. I mean, it's you know, parenting and mothering and being pregnant. It's with all the medical advice. Emotionally, it's very primitive.
Right. Right.
Very, very primitive. People haven't. Well, look, for thousands of years, women were second-class citizens. All
exactly.
they could do is have children.
Sure.
So we haven't healed that.
Right.
So if it wasn't your mother or your grandmother, it certainly was your great-grandmother, and that wasn't named as violence, and that was never healed.
Right.
So that's been passed on to you unhealed, unaddressed.
Right. It's just this energy pattern that just keeps spinning out and spinning and spinning and spinning.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, isn't that basically expressed through the DNA?
No, it's not in the DNA.
No.
It's not you can't change the DNA, but it is in what we call expressed genes. It can determine what genes get turned on and don't get turned on. Now your fundamental DNA is your fundamental DNA. That is just inherited. But behavior patterns, they can be inherited, but they're not genetic.
Right.
It's not in the gene. It depends on whether the gene gets turned on or not.
Okay. All right. So it's related, but it's not.
They're not going to find a gene for it. Let me put it that way.
Okay. All right. Well, then let's go ahead and move this into the discussion about weight, because you do relate weight issues to the same source.
Yes, yes, because there was a very famous study done in Holland about what happened during the Dutch Hunger Winter. The Dutch Hunger Winter was the year when the Nazis were in Holland, and they decided to punish the resistance by limiting everybody in Holland to a diet of only 1,000 calories a day. Babies who had the first 3 months of their gestation during the Dutch Hunger Winter, when they grew up, were obese out of proportion to the rest of the population because they had been starved.
Wow.
And I think that this, the first threat to life is not enough blood. That's the very first threat. And I think what happens ever after, if that's been a threat, because there's not enough blood, because your mother's depressed and there are, you know, hormones in the blood that are keeping you from growing, whatever it is, that any kind of anxiety triggers anxiety around food.
Okay.
So literally with every mouthful, every compulsive mouthful you're eating, you're saying, somebody wants me to live, somebody wants me to live, somebody wants me to live, somebody wants me to live.
Huh. Okay. So then, once again, if that's the case with a certain individual, how do you deal with that? How do you have that?
Well, it's because this is so fundamental, you know, and it also gets reinforced, you know, at the breast, in the crib, and in the playpen, and in nurturing and feeding patterns between mothers and children. Because this is so fundamental, it takes a great deal of work. And the first thing is that I suggest to people is not to be judgmental, to try to be compassionate observers. They're not shooting dope. They're not out murdering other people. They're not raping anybody. They're merely hurting themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And although that's a big merely, just to be and to have compassion, my God, this is the best way that I can deal with my shock.
Right.
You know, and have compassion for that person. And I say to people who have this terror, I said, if your best friend gained 20 pounds, would you like her any less? Would you love her any less? And they immediately say no. So, you know, how people feel about you is not related to your weight. It's not related to what you eat. All that stuff is generated inside, and all that reflects how much your mother did not want her belly to grow when you were in her womb.
Oh, okay. So nowadays when thin is in, and I know people who have not allowed themselves to eat because they don't want to gain weight while they're pregnant. So they're actually harming the child in this way.
Totally, totally. The child is feeling, oh, if I grow, my mother's going to be unhappy. And not only that, the child is fighting with the mother for resources. There aren't enough nutrients for both of them, so the child is battling with the mother.
Uh-huh.
Are you going to get the calories or am I going to get the calories?
Huh, okay. And there's also this underlying communication where there actually is a knowingness on the part of the child that this is
totally. And people have problems because I'm not anti-abortion,
uh-huh.
but I believe that consciousness begins with conception.
Uh-huh.
It's not, but my pro-abortion stance doesn't have to do with the fact that, you know, when consciousness begins, it's the fact that as a species, we've always had, you know, we've always used you know, infanticide as a method of birth control.
Uh-huh.
I mean, abortion is relatively recent because in hunter-gatherer days, if a child was conceived in plenty but born in a time of want, the mother would bury it under a pile of leaves and walk on.
Right.
Because
right.
nature wanted the next child to have a better chance.
Yeah. Hmm. So
it's not that I don't believe we're killing conscious beings.
Right.
You know, I just, and it's not that I believe the mother's life is more important than the baby's. It's just that this is how the species operates.
Right.
You know, you try to optimize the existence of those who are alive. I mean, of those who are, you know, who have the vision and are kind of running things, so to speak.
Well, now, this brings up another point, and I believe you sort of addressed this in the book, that if this is indeed the case, and I'm not arguing with you, I'm totally on board with you, if this is indeed the case, then why doesn't the human race have some sort of a built-in protection against this harm being done to the offspring?
Well, we grew up in a time when nature was the big threat, and we've internalized that, but we haven't been clear about that. In other words, we had built-in protection for the situations back in hunter-gatherer society. But although technology has advanced and civilization has advanced, the nervous system hasn't.
Okay.
So what we have to do is eventually use our cognitive powers to understand what the nervous system is doing and try to convince it to do something else. So if with my cognitive powers I understand that my nervous system, let's say every time I succeed, you know, let's say I'm a business person, you know, but every time I expand my company, I feel like I have to. I end up in a business disaster that bankrupts me. You know? And what I'm understanding is that my nervous system remembers that every time I grew, my mother got nervous and frightened, and I had to stop and curtail my growth,
okay,
so that she would carry me through to term. Well, once I've understood that connection, then I can go back, imagine myself inside the womb, and say, I'm going to grow no matter what, and you'll see it's going to be good for both of us. So I'm actually using my cognitive powers to go back to take an emotional journey and repattern the nervous system, which cannot repattern itself. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it actually does. So basically it's just a matter of consciousness at this point, that as we become more conscious and we have the realization that this is what's been going on, we have now the ability to smooth it out, fix it, repair it, et cetera.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So... Well, is this the kind of thing that you're going to be talking about in your workshop, the one coming up in April?
Yes, it's very much what I'm going to be talking about. And also there's going to be a lot of exercises where people actually get to experience what's happening. When you want to eat, you know, like what part of your body are you feeling? Some people feel it in their jaw. I'm talking not about the real hunger, the compulsion. Some people feel it in their throats. Well, what's that about? What piece of deprivation or stress does that relate to in your life? And how can we go back and repattern that?
Okay. So you will be working with seminar attendees. Are you going to be doing, like, one-on-one work, doing, like, consultations on their specific energy?
Well, I'll be doing a lot of group work, a lot of work where I'll be directing, you know, group in pairs. I do individual work. Sometimes people come to Kripalu a day or two early to do private sessions with me or stay a day or two afterwards. But I also do phone work, and sometimes people just fly out to California to work with me in person.
Okay. Now, let's go ahead and talk about that. Since you do phone work, you do consultations, how would somebody who's listening to this get a hold of you to arrange something like that?
Well, they can email me, and my email is jamtoday, jamtoday, at juliemotz.com, just
okay.
My name. Yeah. They can call me. My number is 415-256-2528, or they can contact me through my website, which is juliemotz.com.
Okay. And then as far as this seminar at Kripalu goes, they can get information at kripalu.org.
Yeah, but I'm going to be doing a free webinar, like
right.
A free seminar on the web on Sunday, February 22nd.
Okay.
And that will be at 7 p.m. Eastern time. It'll
be
a little earlier for other parts of the country.
Okay.
And if they go to my website, I'll post information about that,
okay.
And they can, and for free they can just go on their computers or just on their phones, and then I'll be talking and then I'll be answering questions and people can get a feeling of what the work will be like.
Okay, great. So there's that information. We'll be covering this again before we're done here. And also, once again, all of that information will be on the shapeshiftingonline.com website. So if you're listening to this on your iPod and don't have a pen or whatever, you can find it on the website later on. Let's get back to this this weight thing, because, again, that's what this show is about specifically. One of the things that the website says you're going to talk about at this seminar is that we can discover how our anxiety about food, eating, and our body first developed, which is what we're talking about here, right?
Yeah.
And then as well as the need to use food as a mood-altering substance.
Mm-hmm.
How does that work?
Well, the wonderful thing about food is that it's unlike cocaine or alcohol, which only throw the switch one way. There are two kinds of shock. There's parasympathetic shock, which totally slows you down, and sympathetic shock, which totally revs you up. If you choose the right food, you can pull yourself out of either. Of course, you usually pull yourself out of one by throwing yourself into the other. But it's a way of actually pulling yourself out of shock and soothing yourself.
Okay.
And it's a little more complicated because depending on what emotion feels most threatening to you, you'll choose different foods to deal with that.
Oh, really? Like
so, well, the four emotions that we don't want to feel are fear, anger, pain, and need. Because those are the emotions of danger. You use fear to perceive danger. You use anger to act in response to danger. You use pain to understand danger, and you use need to get help in danger.
Okay.
And those are the four emotions that are least tolerated by parents in a family.
Okay.
Fear, anger, pain, and need. So what happens eventually, is since you know that that's going to upset mommy or daddy, is when that feeling starts to come to the surface, you feel your life is in danger. If you want to not feel fear, you tend to eat oils and fats.
Okay.
If you want to not feel anger, you tend to eat salt and protein and sour things. If you want to not feel pain, you tend to eat complex carbohydrates, starches.
Okay.
If you want to not feel need, you tend to eat sugar.
Okay, so
and any combination of these, because there may be more than one emotion that,
sure.
that feels threatening to you to feel.
Right, so we can kind of see by what we are reaching for in the closet, if we're reaching for, you know, like you said, sweets, then we can say, okay, well, if I'm reaching for sweets, then I must be feeling this specific emotion.
Then it's this terrible, terrible infant need that is coming up and frightening me that I don't want to feel.
Okay, and then by realizing this, you can step back from the food and say, okay, well, what's going on inside me?
Yeah, and what I do is I go to the place in my body where I feel it,
okay,
and I close my eyes and I ask, how old am I in that part of my body?
Mm-hmm.
And then I try to drift back to that age.
Okay.
And see what the scene is. But when I do this, I give myself permission to eat the food anyway. I say the purpose of this is not to avoid the binge.
Okay.
The purpose of this is to gain insight. Otherwise, you'll feel so anxious that you might not get to eat it, that you won't be able to relax and do the exercise. So you have to totally give yourself permission to say, when this is over, I can go ahead and eat the food.
Uh-huh.
You know? But I'm trying to gain some insight into my patterns.
Right, right. That's
and eventually the patterns will erode.
Wow, what amazing stuff here. Once again, I come back to as the parent, after all we've discussed here, there are so many ways that we're harming our kids.
We live in such an unconscious society, and parents are not free from that. Parents aren't trained to be conscious, you know,
right.
any more than anybody else, and that's what's so tragic. You know, that's really so tragic.
Right. It's a forgive them, Father, they know not what they do kind of thing.
Yeah,
you don't
yeah.
know what you're doing.
Yeah.
So how can we then, as parents, become more aware of what we're doing to our kids?
By becoming more aware of your own history. I discovered this a long time ago. I don't have children myself, but I have an adored niece. And when her daughter was born, the baby, I flew back, you know, right away and helped. And I would discover there would be times when I would be with Isabella, the baby, and I would start to feel bored. And I think, I don't want to do this. I want to go read a book. I want to do something adult. And the moment that happened, I would give the baby back to my niece, and I would say, I need to take some time for myself. And I would go into my feeling, and inevitably, some tremendous feeling of pain about what I had not gotten as an infant was coming up in me.
Wow.
So this gave me an insight that what you need to realize is that when you're upset with your kids, something about your own childhood, usually at the very age of the child you're upset with, is coming up, and you need to take time out and work on that. It's not a question of whether the child is doing is right or wrong. You're not even able to see it because you've gone so much into shock around your own childhood or infancy
right.
that you're not coming from an adult place. So you need to take the time out. Time outs are really for parents, not for children.
Right.
So you need to take that time out and do that work. It's tremendously difficult work. It's much harder than running a corporation.
Yes.
It is the work of disciplined consciousness, which is the most difficult work there is. But there's no greater reward than doing that around a child.
Right. Yeah.
And where you fail to do it, if you do it 10 years later, you just apologize. Nothing falls so sweetly on the ears of a child as an apology from a parent. But it has to be specific. It can't be, oh, I'm sorry for every bad thing I did to you. It's like, gee, I just remembered that on this day I was doing this and I was feeling that and that's what I did. It has to be, the apologies to children have to be very specific or they don't trust it.
Right. Yeah, that's true. Now, how about sexual abuse and eating? How is that related with your...
Well, actually, I'm doing a webinar on sexual abuse February 7th. That's actually February 8th, rather, Sunday, and that'll actually be 10 p.m. East Coast time because it's most of the people who are going to come to that workshop live on the West Coast.
Okay.
But anybody can tune in. You know, because I made this early connection between having to take whatever comes into your body in the womb and sexual abuse.
Uh-huh.
Sexual abuse triggers the memory of the early discomfort around not getting enough nurture. And so it throws you back into shock from that. And so one of the ways of keeping the memories of sexual abuse at bay is to eat, because sexual abuse again brings up the feeling of I'm going to die. And the other reason it brings up that feeling is that sexual abuse, because I tried to figure out, I'm a sexual abuse survivor, so what is so terrible if he or she put his finger there or his what's to see? What is so terrible about that?
Uh-huh.
You know, and there's always the, oh, it's touching your vital energy, blah, blah, that just didn't satisfy me.
Uh-huh.
You know, I thought, look, everything is about survival of the individual or survival of the species. Survival of the individual or survival of the species. How did it affect me on that level? And then I realized that the people who abuse children have this murderous feeling towards them. And what is so horrible about sexual abuse is that this murderous feeling is coming at you in the guise of sexuality.
Huh.
But you secretly know this person wants to wipe you out.
Right.
And that's the part. And that's what makes it so hard to remember, and that's why people suppress it, because very often the earliest abuser is a parent on whom you're totally dependent.
Right.
You know, you may think your problem is that you got raped at 27. You wouldn't have walked down that dark alley if you hadn't already been in shock from having maybe even touched inappropriately when you were 7 months.
Huh.
You wouldn't go anywhere near that place or that person.
Wow. Okay.
So sexual abuse is very closely related, particularly in cases of things like bulimia. I was bulimic. Anorexia or obesity.
Okay.
Because you don't do something that grotesque to your body unless something grotesque was done to your body. Unless
right.
You're trying to show people, something happened to me. Something happened to this body. Look, something happened.
Right. Well, now, I've, on a different facet of that same subject, the fact that you are changing the way that your body looks so that it's not so-called sexually attractive.
Yeah. You know, I know that's touted. I don't think that's a factor. I think when people are eating, they're not thinking about how their body's going to look.
Uh-huh.
They're just feeling this intense anxiety. I've got to get that food in my body no matter what.
Okay, so basically your theory, your concept that you work with is that this all begins in the womb, basically?
Yes, in the womb. It's sort of like, you know, when you know the old story of the man who's looking for his keys and looking for his keys and he's looking around and around this lamppost and another man comes up and said, well, where did you drop them? He said, well, I dropped them over there across the street. He said, why are you looking here? He said, well, this is where the light is. You know, when you've looked where the light is and you're not finding the keys, you've got to look in the places where no one has shined any light.
Right.
And that is in the womb and in infancy. And I got to this because I realized, it's kind of a long story, I write about it in my book, that patients under surgery were going back to prenatal memories.
Right.
And that got me interested. So I spent 2 years taking workshops where I did prenatal regressions, where I went back to my own intrauterine life and discovered incredible things and incredible patterns I hadn't been able to change, that they had started there.
Okay. Now, one of the things that you will actually do with somebody, at least in the book, you, I don't know how to put this into words, you can probably do this better, but you read their energy fields. You can help them to you can actually name for them when you're doing your medical intuitive work.
I may not be able to tell you whether you have cirrhosis or cancer of the liver, but I can certainly tell you there's something going on in your liver that needs to be addressed.
Okay. Well, like, for example, in your book, you were talking about having some work done on a sore shoulder, and it turned out that the reason your shoulder was sore to begin with was, go ahead and tell the story.
Oh, that was my very first experience with Reiki, because my mother used to smack me across the left side of my face being right-handed, and I would pull that shoulder up to protect me.
so then later on in life when you were feeling
when
that
I,
you were
I,
in a
I,
similar circumstance.
I had a fall in the acrobatics class and the shoulder froze.
Okay.
And didn't unfreeze.
Right. And so by healing this thing that happened as you were a child, that released the tightness, the frozen.
Well, essentially, a shoulder didn't have to hold the memory and try to function as a shoulder at the same time. And that's what happens when body parts break down. It's because they're holding the tension of a movement they wanted to make and weren't allowed to make and having to function as the body part at the same time. And at some point they say, look, brain, you'd better bring this to consciousness because I can't do both these jobs anymore.
Okay. Well, I'm also wondering, I've been doing some looking into my ancestry, just for fun, just to see, you know, where my relatives were from and if I could track them down. And I discovered that one of my grandparents, her ancestry is pure German, so German that it goes back to when Germany was called Prussia.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was really very interesting that a big chunk of my, you know, the energy patterns that have been passed down to me was a very strict Prussian.
Have you read any of Alice Miller's books?
No, I haven't.
She's a very brilliant Swiss psychiatrist.
Uh-huh.
She wrote a book, it was either Thou Shalt Not Be Aware or For Your Own Good, and she's attempting to explain the rise of Hitler and why it happened in Germany. She talks about German child-rearing practices.
Uh-huh.
And how these were the standard, these were the Dr. Spock books of their day.
Uh-huh.
They talk about tying down the infant's hands in the crib so it can't move.
Wow.
They talk about if the infant has a favorite toy, you take it away for 10 minutes. If it cries, you take it away the next day for 20 minutes. If it still cries, you take it away for half an hour. You take it away for longer and longer periods of time until it doesn't cry at all. You do this all before the age of 2, so the infant will not remember and will not associate you, the parent, with his cruelty.
Wow. And
these were the rules for raising children in Germany. This was the Dr. Spock of German child rearing, all up until the early 20th century.
Wow.
So that may give you some insight into your ancestry.
Yeah, yeah.
And the strictness and how it played itself out.
Right. So to take this even further, I'm looking at how this, you know, I mean, I didn't even really know the woman. So you would think, you know, on a regular everyday level that, you know, this would have no effect on me. But it actually does, because that is passed down to my father and passed down to me, and then I passed to my kids.
Violence. Unhealed violence.
Yeah.
Unhealed and unnamed violence.
Wow. In the name of doing good. You think that
in the name of being good, and it's called good. I have, in my own history, my ancestors are Eastern European Jews, I have what I call the violence of wealth and the violence of poverty. On my father's side is the violence of poverty. I have, he was sort of an uncle and a cousin. He was the son of my father's brother, my father's cousin. And the story is told that he came in on a snowy day with wet clothes, was told to stand in the fire, stood too close, and caught on fire. And his father, instead of running to his rescue, sat in the corner bowing and praying and bowing and praying and bowing and praying. And he lived his whole life with third-degree burns on his body, scars.
Wow.
But the story is told of what a wonderful religious family you come from.
Huh.
Not that your great-granduncle went in shock and didn't save his child from burning.
Right.
On my mother's side, my mother's family were quite wealthy. My great-grandmother had 16 children. They were all sent out to wet nurses, and my great-grandmother was considered a very clever businesswoman. She paid the wet nurses money, but she gave them food, but forced them to eat it in front of her so it would go into their breast milk and they wouldn't take it home to give to their starving children. And this is told as what a wonderful businesswoman your great-grandmother was.
Wow!
So you have the violence of wealth, the violence of poverty on both sides, and neither is being named as violence. In fact, they're being praised as religiosity on one side and business smarts on the other.
Wow. Oh, this just goes so deep, doesn't it?
It does. We all come from violent histories, no matter what continent we're from.
Right.
We come from violent histories. And if the violence isn't named and healed in some pattern, it may have been physical violence in one level and it continues on psychological violence next generation. Until it's named and healed, it goes on. And our when we talk about stopping the violence, the way we stop the violence is to investigate its effects on our own history.
Right.
And that changes everything in the family.
Right. Yeah. By healing yourself, then you offer healing to others. I know that there are family members that I'm working with where we're all sort of we're turning this into sort of this mystery to be solved. Okay, well, how did this happen? And you know, we're trying to take away all judgment. We're not judging anybody for doing what they did because they were just doing what they learned how to do. So when you can look at it that way and you pick apart the pieces of the puzzle, it can be fascinating work.
It is fascinating. And in general, when people say, what can I do for my child? I say, heal yourself.
Right.
That is the best thing you can do for your child.
Wow. Wow, amazing stuff. Well, we are just about out of time here. I do want to make sure that we mention all of your information once again. Website, juliemotz.com. That's M-O-T-Z. And if you want to call Julie, set up a consultation, or find out more information about her webinars and seminar, the number is 415-256-2528. Once again, this information will be on the shapeshiftingonline.com radio page. We've got the How to Have an Appetite You Can Trust and a Body You Can Love seminar. Is that a two-day seminar weekend?
That's a weekend seminar. It starts Friday night and it ends early Sunday afternoon.
Okay, and that's at Kropalo in the Berkshires. Information on that is kropalo.org. And that one is April, what's the dates?
It's April 24th to the 27th.
Okay, great. And then you've got two upcoming webinars during February. One is going to be on, what is it?
Healing Sexual Wounds.
Okay.
Is February 8th, and that's 10 p.m. Eastern Time.
Okay.
And How to Have an Appetite You Can Trust and a Body You Can Love is February 22nd, and that's 7 p.m. Eastern Time.
Okay, and if people call in on that one, they will hear you talking about a lot of the stuff we've discussed today, and that'll be deliberately, specifically focused just on that topic.
Absolutely, and it's free, yeah.
Okay, great, and it's free. That's even better, isn't it? So anything else do you think we need to mention, or do you think we've covered it all?
Well, I guess we could talk about the election and, and what's happening in Israel and Palestine. I mean, there are a few subjects still left, but perhaps best left for another time, another place, and maybe even another interviewee.
There you go. Sounds good. Well, fantastic. I deeply appreciate your being here today. I think this is probably one of the most interesting I know for me personally, one of the most interesting shows I've ever been a part of. Okay. Once again, thanks for everybody for being here. Bye-bye.